Okay, great. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the weekly CCG meeting. Today, we're joined by Venkatesh Rao and a number of researchers from the Summer of Protocols program. They're going to talk to us about it. So Venkatesh is a deep thinker, and I'm delighted he could join us today. If you haven't come across his writing, I recommend you start with his blog, Rhythm Farm. And Protocols is a research program sponsored by the Ethereum Foundation. I think it has some really interesting adjacent and related concepts to our work at the CCG. Hopefully this will spark interesting discussions. So before we get started with that, I'll just run through the admin. So code of ethics and professional conduct. You know, be kind, treat people with respect. Let's continue to work together to create a friendly, welcoming community here. Thank you. Pepino, so anyone's welcome to participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. Quick note about the calls. So these calls are recorded and the minutes will be sent out afterwards. We use IRC to queue speakers or JC chat. You can just raise your hand and we will manage a queue. Okay. Any introductions or reintroductions? Do anyone want to jump on the queue and say hello briefly? Anyone going? Gone? Okay. Announcements and reminders. Does anyone have any announcements for the community or things they want to say? Nope. No announcements. Oh, Harrison. Hey.
Yeah, a quick note. So next week is the Internet Identity Workshop, so that we will not have a CCG meeting next Tuesday because a lot of people won't be able to join. So I will send out a reminder about that as well. So we will not have a meeting next Tuesday.
Great. Okay. Well, that's it for everyone. Then I'll hand over to Venkatesh and we'll start with the presentation. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for having us on. It's a pleasure to be here. And in some ways, this is almost the ideal forum for us to be talking about what we've been doing, since this is kind of a topic that flies under the radar, and that's kind of almost what makes it interesting, protocols and standards. So some background: the Summer Protocols is a summer research program funded by the Ethereum Foundation, and the goal is to give grants to people working on protocols in the broadest sense. So on the looser, wide scope aspects of protocols that normally don't get as much attention as the detailed technical aspects of any particular protocol. So by the broadest sense, we mean everything from what is the culture of handshakes in a given culture? How does governance in Ethereum work? What is the royal protocol in an imperial medieval court? So any usage of the word protocol is in scope for us. So the pilot year was last year, and we are now in the second year, and we are actually in the application phase for the second year's grant program. Applications close this Friday. So if any of you are interested, please check out summerprotocols.com. The call for applications is there. And you can also go to, if you're interested in just being a bit of a spectator, there's forum.summerprotocols.com where people post their RFCs, request for comments, for their applications and proposals this year. So you can see there's like 60 odd RFCs there, and we'll be able to only fund about five significant projects. So we have two grants, a larger grant for two full-time researchers to do a bigger project, and a small micro grant program. So for the larger program, we have like 60 applications for five spots this year. So we have an exciting time ahead to pick five. Okay, so that's the background. So the way this program started was almost a year and a half ago, Tim Baco, who's part of the EF, reached out to me to basically discuss broader philosophical and managerial issues around Ethereum. And he and I and a few other people from the EF, including Josh Stark, started basically discussing these broad-based issues. And we wrote a pilot study called the Unreasonable Sufficiency of Protocols, which you can find on the site. But while doing that work, we realized that the topic is far broader than our conversations could hope to cover. And we realized it would be a really good idea to start a program just focused on these broad aspects, trying to like step back and look beyond the immediate technical issues, not just of Ethereum, but of protocols in general. So deliberate intent from the get-go was to focus on general problems and issues that were specifically instantiated in the Ethereum world. So, for example, the ossification of the blockchain, but in a broad scope way. So ossification is a problem. So this is the term that in the blockchain world is used to refer to what happens to a blockchain as it matures and ages. But this is a problem that you encounter in everything from, like, you know, cities to railway infrastructures, to, even measurement standards, or to talk about the stuff you guys talk about, like protocols and standards around how credentials are used in a society, right? So everything ossifies, but there's a sense in which it's worthwhile to study it broadly. So that's kind of how it started. Last year, we funded 12 significant what we call core projects, and about 20 what we call affiliate projects that built on the core projects. You can see the research as we publish it online. And I would say the philosophical core of the program last year was to just establish the ground as that there's a there, that there is such a thing we could call protocol science or protocol studies. And I think we convinced ourselves that there is such a thing. We did what we called nerd snipe ourselves. So we kind of like all got really interested in the topic. We protocol pilled ourselves, another term we use, sort of went down various bunny trails, and it was all super interesting. And I'd say the lighthouse idea for our explorations was a quote by Alfred North Whitehead, which goes, "Civilization advances by increasing the number of operations we can do without thinking about them." So this idea became our North Star, and all the research projects kind of like loosely orbited this idea of like, what are these unconscious layer of civilizational infrastructure, including, you know, familiar things like, you know, screw gauge standards or, naming conventions, all the way to, like soft things like handshakes, like I mentioned, to now climate protocols, blockchain. So all these things are kind of belong in these invisible layers that improve our lives, but we don't think about them. And last year's overall outcome, I would say, was we convinced ourselves protocol science is a thing and that it should be a first-class citizen in how we think about the world. And this year's focus, I would say, is move a little downstream from that and start to establish a kind of like a praxis or discipline we think of as protocol entrepreneurship, by which we mean take a domain that has like some protocolized elements to it and think about either improving the protocols in them or perhaps dismantling the protocols. Maybe it should not be that protocolized and maybe it should be more loose and free-flowing, right? So both protocolization and deprotocolization in an entrepreneurial sense are in scope. And we want to ask, what does it take to be a protocol entrepreneur? How does it differ from being a regular entrepreneur or a startup founder in Silicon Valley? How is it different from simply being like, you know, long-term bureaucrat in a government agency? How is it different from being one of our researchers, David Lang, called a standards entrepreneur in his research? His paper is also online. But by standards entrepreneur, he meant like, you know, almost a 19th century model of if you think everybody should use a standard screw threading standard, how do you go about like establishing that as a standard? And he studied how that practice evolved over a century. But protocols are more complex, more dynamic things. They involve code. They involve statefulness. So protocols are a richer construct, and presumably protocol entrepreneurship is a more challenging thing than standards entrepreneurship. So we want to see what it takes to establish that. Thought I want to plant in your mind is, I'm a big fan of the show Doctor Who, and recently I noticed that recent seasons of Doctor Who use the word protocol a lot. So this is the reboot since 2007 or so. So I got curious and I went to a database and searched for the word protocol in the scripts. And it turns out that before the 2007 reboot, so seasons up to around 1998, the word protocol was used a grand total of 2 times in all seasons. So between like 1950, whatever, to 1998, just 2 uses of the word protocol. But since the new version started, there have been 70 or 72 uses of the word. So something is clearly going on. And you see this pattern all over. The word protocol is used over and over more often. And I think what's happening is that ever since the internet became a thing, the world has gotten more protocolized and we are becoming more aware of the fact. We think of our environment as this artificial technological environment defined by protocols. So it's kind of a exciting environment to be in, and I think it's the right time to be studying protocolization. And the immediate impetus for us, in fact, was when Twitter got bought by Elon Musk and everybody got excited about Mastodon and then Blue Sky, and in the crypto world there's a thing called Farcaster. So it's kind of the right time, and there was a lot of discourse around it a couple of years ago, and that's when we got started. But I've said enough, so I'll just quickly introduce the other people on the call with me. Josh Stark is with the EF, and he's been studying the concept of hardness that he'll be talking about. Then we have Dorian. We'll start with Chanot. Chanot Hart is an architect, and she studied protocols in urban space addressing. Then we'll talk to Dorian Taylor, who works on basically web technologies, and he's come up with a protocol for publishing web content. And finally, Spencer Chang, who studied kind of like softer aspects of how we preserve memory and protocols for like preserving and developing your identity through memory habits. So those are the 4 people we'll hear from very quickly. So over to Josh Stark to kick us off, then Chanot, then Dorian, then Spencer. Josh?
Hey, thanks, Venkatesh. And hello, everybody. Thank you for taking the time and inviting us here. I think we're all excited to chat with you folks. So as Venkatesh said, I work at the EF, where I serve as part of the leadership team, and I've been involved with summer protocols going back to some early discussions with Tim and Venkatesh and others. Venkatesh asked me to just do a very brief introduction to the EF and maybe how we relate to protocols, and then talk a bit about this idea of hardness, which is something I've been writing about, which intersects nicely, I think, with some of the topics from summer protocols. So, briefly, 3 important concepts about the Ethereum Foundation. First, as you might imagine, we are focused on Ethereum, developing it, bettering it for its future, making it a useful set of technologies for the human species. 2 things you might not expect that come out of that are that, one, we think of that as a long-term focus. We're interested in ensuring that Ethereum serves its ecosystem, not just the one that exists today, but the one that will exist in the future when there may be billions of people interacting with Ethereum or the systems that integrate with it in some fashion. And the other is that we, really think a lot about, the kind of, culture and values and philosophy side of things. It has been joked before that Ethereum is really a philosophy project masquerading as a technical implementation. And we know that the ideas here and the rationale for it is a big piece of that. And so we try to pay attention to that as well. Second idea about the EF is that we're not really one institution or one company. It is really a community of teams. Most teams at the EF are quite independent. They're just part of this larger umbrella of infrastructure that, we maintain. And if you're not too familiar with the Ethereum ecosystem, you should know that, of course, there are many, many organizations, companies, teams outside of the EF itself who contribute to the protocol and play a large role in understanding it and developing it and improving it. And the third idea that's important to understand about the EF is that we take really seriously and follow what we call a philosophy of subtraction. And this is the idea that, it is natural for institutions to want to accumulate power and to accumulate influence and prestige. And we know that we have to push back against that. We very actively want to make space for others to step up and contribute to the protocol and to share the responsibilities of maintaining this public good, this open source project for others. And so we try to have a quite light touch, and we think very intentionally about where we can subtract ourselves so that others can add to the ecosystem in our place. So that's the EF broadly. as we just said, this kind of kicked out of some thinking and discussions about, you know, questions that kept coming up, you know, both inside the Ethereum Foundation and just in this ecosystem more broadly. There are many teams at the EF that interact with the Ethereum protocol. There are some teams that do research and are trying to understand the cutting edge of, you know, what new cryptography will enable and how the protocol could be improved, hardened, made more scalable, more useful for human beings. Other teams at the EF might be more involved in development and implementation of how do we actually create the software that's going to implement that protocol and make it function at scale. And then some teams are also more involved in the coordination side of things, convening forums, bringing parties together, facilitating or mediating discussions and consensus building, contributing to standards that are used by the ecosystem. And many similar questions kept coming up, you know, questions around how should a protocol evolve? When should a protocol ossify or have changes slowed down? How should we even talk about these things? And, you know, how might talking about them in certain ways actually impact how the protocol is seen to be stable or not, or changing or not? And that led to, you know, a belief that there were a more general form of this problem out in the world. And maybe by understanding the more general form of protocols, we could understand Ethereum better. So that's the Ethereum Foundation and maybe a few ways that we interact with the, you know, capital P world of protocols. Venkatesh also asked me to talk a bit about hardness. So I wrote a blog post, I think about 2 years now, called Atoms, Institutions, and Blockchains. And this really came out of an effort from myself to, I guess, articulate like what I actually believe about this. Why am I dedicating my career, my life to, you know, making these things work and making them serve humanity? And what is the biggest picture narrative that makes sense of them and actually makes them fit into the world that I understand? And the basic idea here is that I think underneath many of these critical pieces of infrastructure that our civilization relies on, things like identity, things like money, things like law and contracts, there's this really fundamental capability that I call hardness. And, you know, the fact of this shared capability, this shared abstract property, is why we can actually sometimes substitute blockchains for institutions. You know, it is certainly true that there are people out there who use a blockchain-based money instead of an institutionally-based money. It's also true there are people who use blockchain-based, you know, financial instruments or is what are essentially contracts when they could have used an institutionally-based form of the same thing through, you know, traditional legal systems. So if they're substitutes, they must have something at root in common between them. The analogy I often try to use is that it kind of feels like we are looking at a lot of technologies and what we now call information technologies, but without the concept of information. There was a time in the not too distant past when the abstract idea of information didn't exist. Now we understand that, you know, speech or text or our DNA or, you know, pieces of a magnetized disc are all just different mediums for information. But that's a pretty novel understanding. And I think when it comes to things like law and money and identity and institutions and blockchains, there's a similarly fundamental thing here that if we can identify and articulate clearly, maybe we can talk about these things from a more distant, higher and more understanding vantage point. So what actually is hardness? And I'll try to keep this brief. It is the ability to make the future more certain in specific ways. It is all the ways that we lay down this scaffolding of confidence onto which we hang and bolt all these complex social infrastructure that our civilization requires. In the case of identity, obviously one thing I care about with my identity, you know, the identity of Josh Stark, a Canadian citizen, is that I will continue to be able to use that identity in the future and that someone else can't take it from me. And that if someone else were to try to use it, there would be some sort of process for me to recover it and be able to continue paying my taxes, getting access to healthcare, etc. I care about that future reliability. And the way I put this in my terminology is that the source of hardness for certain rules or boundaries of my identity are really, they're sourced to institutions, to, you know, the system of government, the bureaucracies, etc., that make up the Canadian state that have, you know, been trained over centuries to be quite reliable. You know, all of us probably believe that there are certain institutions that, you know, 100 years from now, they'll still be following certain instructions we've given them. Instructions in the form of legislation or common law or just the, you know, systems and rules of a bureaucracy that have acquired over time. And like an institution can give hardness to an identity, so could a blockchain in comparable ways by providing certain guarantees through its design, through the incentive it creates, through this cryptography that is used to create it, that it too will be there and functioning in a predictable way 100 years from now. So that is a very brief overview of the idea and a concise application to the world of identity. There's a lot more in the blog post, which I think someone has shared in the chat already. And obviously, I'm happy to chat about it later. But I'll pass it over there to the next speaker.
So Chanel is next. Chanel, are you there? Are you muted?
Is it working now?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Hello, I'm Chanel Hart, and I am an architectural designer. My core research project, Addressable Space, covered how physical addressing schemes and place names in the built environment take on some of the characteristics of digital addressing schemes. So a building address in physical space is in some ways similar to a type of digital information. And so historically, to summarize my research, building addresses were developed in the 18th and 19th centuries as a result of government consolidation over territories. So a building might acquire an address in order to collect taxes on that property or to map the population for government conscription rather than necessarily for wayfinding or the convenience of people navigating physical space. So then in a way, those physical addresses are decoupled and can be decoupled from their literal locations. And that occurs historically where in some older European cities, addressing schemes are not necessarily consistent with physical location. And then I was, with my research, looking for other examples of that type of informational decoupling in the world, such as elevators skipping floors inside a building, the flexibility of business names, where the name of a chain retail business can point to multiple different physical locations that are all connected by the same name. And then more modern examples like cloud kitchens, where one place can potentially do business under two different names on a delivery app. And with those sharing economy apps, there's less user awareness of the destinations involved. And those are all very digital characteristics, comparable to how when you type in the web address for a website, you don't necessarily need to have any awareness of where the servers for the website are located. And I've been interested in the potential of that decoupling in more areas of our physical world, especially as we use increasing numbers of screens and digital interfaces, such as in elevators or in cars or on our phone, to navigate physical space. Thank you.
All right. Dorian, you're up next.
I think Maven was unable to get Jitsi to work. I did email him to ask him to try Chrome, but I'm not sure if he's on the call still.
Okay, then let's switch to Spencer. Spencer?
Hey, Ron, can you hear me? Audio is good?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Can I share my screen? Or will that?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's fine. Should be fine.
I'll just, just to provide some images while I share. So hey everyone, my name is Spencer. I'm a programmer and artist, focusing on creating ways for, computers to bring people together. And so for Summer of Protocols, I was an affiliate researcher, so I sort of weave between a couple, projects, helping the core researchers. But my overall focus was on memory and specifically archival practices that lead us to memory. So this took form in one speculative artifact around exploring how we create memory through our collections of physical things and also digital objects. This centered around this idea of like a memory pouch, which are these devices that let you, this future device that could recreate any sort of physical experience into a perfect reproduction. So whether it's through touch or smell or sense, and weaved into sort of how we could bridge that gap in our existing world now. So I sort of created a bunch of these folk memory pouches through available tools I had. And so you can see here, like, I just created this pouch out of like a scarf and a bag, like a laundry bag that I had, and designating these containers as ways for specific collections of things. I was exploring how that form of archival not only is a form of personal expression, but also through like offers this site of exchange for creating connection between communities. And that's sort of one of the other things I started exploring in Summer Protocols and have sort of like continued after in that process is this open source library. It's called PlayHTML. And basically it focuses on that that exchange through memory. It allows people to create and design shared web experiences. So this is sort of all real time affected for anyone on the website, and it stays persistent over time. You can see some examples here. This is sort of like internet fridge wall, and people can leave messages here over time and also collectively shape it. So that's sort of where my thinking is at now around how to create the infrastructure for people to facilitate these sites of exchange through the memory and archival of things that they care about.
All right. Thanks, Spencer. And I want to quickly share my screen and show our website here. So you guys have a sense of where to go look for more. So summerprotocols.com, if you go and click on the research tab here, you'll see a lot of the works we've referenced plus a lot more. So we're publishing it slowly in the form of what we're calling a protocol kit. So the physical version is like printed pieces that go in a three-ring binder, but it's all available online as well. So there's, I think, about 15, 20 pieces already published and then another 30 or 40 more coming. So there's a lot of content here. And if any of you are interested, you can request one of these protocol kits. We have a few left still. So that might be fun and interesting. And I did want to point out that we have the call for applications for 2024 on. And like I mentioned, there's a large grant called the Protocol Improvement Grant. That's two people, 90,000 over the summer to work on improving a specific protocol. And then the Protocol Pill Challenge, which is to do little works to basically memeify, like make protocols meme-like subject. And we are working with a bunch of partners as well. The applications are due this Friday. So I know it's a very short time, but I thought I'd shill the program for those of you who might have great ideas to work on. And for those of you who are curious about what's going on this year, if you go to forum.summerprotocols.com and click on this RFCs category, you'll see all the ideas that people are proposing to work on this year. So I'm kind of excited to dive in and make the, assessments of which ones might be interesting to fund this year. So that'll be my week next week. So with that, I think I'll stop here and we'll take questions. So yeah.
You, Harrison.
All right. Chanel, do you mind actually go a little bit deeper into your research about the addressable space? Like, what are the three or four takeaways when there's a decoupling between physical and digital addressable objects or identities, if you will? Because I'm quite interested in this because I know there's a lot of huge companies just working on physical addresses, right? Like, you know, trying to clean and standardize them. And it's always that 8 or 10% that mess you up, right? And also, I think at W3C, CCG, we have been talking about content addressable IDs versus like location addressable IDs and things like that. So quite interested to hear your thoughts in regards to, you know, the key takeaways when the decoupling happens. Yeah.
That's an interesting question. One of the big takeaways that I found is that there's the potential for deception and manipulation when the physical and the digital addresses are separate. So, for instance, I found several examples where buildings were misrepresenting how tall they actually were, potentially in some cases by 10 or 20 stories in height. So, for instance, there's the phenomenon of buildings in East Asian countries eliminating the number 4 from their floor numbers, similarly to how we eliminate the number 13 in Western culture. And that's sort of a simple example, but there was a building in Vancouver which eliminated all of its floors ending in 4 and then was represented as being almost 10 stories higher than it was because those floors were eliminated for the numbering. Or another building in New York, which had a large multi-story empty space between its lower and higher floors. So that's one kind of potential manipulation which occurs. And I'm interested in researching that kind of manipulation, which also occurs with cloud kitchens, for example, where you can order food and not necessarily know where it's coming from. And I mean, I'm curious about how that type of manipulation could occur in the future. And then I also think it's interesting as the built environment acquires more types of sensors and with things like smart cities or increasing automation in the built environment, could the understanding of how physical space relates to digital address, that could potentially be relevant for looking at how we map the built environment in terms of understanding that there's different ways of representing information. And then I also think that that type of information literacy is important when we're using digital interfaces to navigate the built environment, such as, for instance, how elevators are starting to have touch screens to access the buttons. So the floor numbers on a building could be reprogrammed kind of dynamically.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. I just thought throwing up the visual would help people understand what you're talking about, you know. Did she drop? Let me stop. Oh, hold on.
I think there probably were a technical difficulty earlier.
Sorry, my connection dropped out. I think I'm here now.
Oh, sorry. Shinoh, I thought it would be useful to throw up the visual of your appendix, and I did that, and that's when you cut out. Sorry about that. Stopped sharing. Yeah. Go ahead.
I mean, I think I was getting close to what I was summarizing. I mean, I guess the main takeaway is that it's important for people in the world to have this kind of literacy about different ways that spatial information can be sort of mapped and represented, because I think that there's going to be more and more situations in the future where it's relevant as we get more technology in our physical environment. And that's all.
Thank you.
Cool. Yeah, I actually was going to ask the same question, but I have a different question maybe for Josh. It's really just to expand on the house concept, which I think is, you know, really interesting. I guess, like, I'm thinking about credentials and, you know, in our space, we kind of have this maybe layering of hardness. Like there's the institution or the entity that issues it, but then we're kind of adding in some cryptography to make the credential harder. But I think the root, the source of the hardness ultimately does fall back to the institution. I don't, it's not a question. I don't know if you could just talk around that.
happy to talk around it. I was looking at some of the docs for this group beforehand and, seeing the word, you know, verifiable come up, over and over again. I was trying to kind of like look at, okay, in how you conceptualize, you know, what is the thing you're looking at? Where in this sentence, is a reference to, you know, what I might call hardness in a more abstract way. And I think it kind of comes down, at least in that expression, to this verifiability idea. I think, you know, an unstated thing, when we talk about verifiability of some identity claim, is that it will be verifiable in the future. You know, we're not expecting just that for some brief time horizon, that this will be verifiable, but that there's some sort of, you know, multi-layered thing here that will persist long into the future. And that at the point at which, you know, some institution needs to contact me, or that there is some sort of incentive or disincentive applied to me in some system, that there will be a way to, you know, verifiably connect some action to some identity later on. So that's kind of one thought I had on that, I guess. The other is that, yes, there's many like layers to this. I don't know how practically useful the concept of hardness is in a lot of like the applications of what we're doing, because, you know, as practitioners in an area of some application that is using hardness at root, you already have a pretty sophisticated way of understanding what are the properties of this thing, what are the claims that are being made, what are the reasons that those claims will be hard in the future. I think where we get some use out of the idea is in looking at the kind of, you know, bigger picture of these systems, or in thinking about where there are opportunities to I guess like change or alter that source of hardness, right? I think that if you understand that at root we're doing a similar thing when we have an institution, you know, be this durable, enduring thing that can last and make certain claims and make certain things true in the future, that if we can articulate that in a more abstract way, we can maybe look for other systems that provide a similar kind of guarantees or abstract properties, and not just assume that there's only one way of doing it. I think a lot of what the blockchain world is really doing is trying to dig deeper into, you know, how we already use things like money or identity in order to translate them into a different world, to a system that provides similar and fundamentally, but maybe not exactly the same set of capabilities or affordances. I hope some of that was clear, Will, or was getting at what you're interested in hearing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that last bit really resonated with me from my background just in studying cryptography protocols, right? Like, define some abstract thing that we want to try to realize different ways with maybe different properties that are interesting. Cool. Thank you. Kuya, I thought you put a comment in the chat. Do you want to voice it?
Sure. I'm super excited to find the protocol nerds, because I'm one of them. I just commented, in 2005, I found this book, a Strand's book called Protocol, How Control Exists After Decentralization by Alexander Galway. And I was just curious how much, one, if you knew about the book and how much that work had been informed, like if you had used it to inform what you were doing with your summer protocols and other research.
Yeah, happy to respond to that. Yes, that book was on our radar through last year summer, and one specific research project it influenced, I'm posting the link in the chat right now, Nadia Aspurova, she did a research project called Dangerous Protocols. So she studied like how, even though right now we are in a little bit of an idealistic utopian part of the discourse, where most people are excited about how protocols are better than platforms and how we can get away from the, you know, downsides of centralized platforms by building P2P or decentralized protocols, that these things just kind of like transpose the various potential abuses and, you know, power struggles and political aspects of platforms to a different key. They just rear their heads in a different way. Plus, of course, some things improve and there are entirely new issues that come up. So, yeah, this is one of the more fun research projects that came out of last summer, Dangerous Protocols. And I think the book kind of like broadly influenced Nadia's essay, but it is about, I don't know, 15, 16 years ago. And if you look at Google Trends, you'll actually see that around the time that book came out is when the last peak of like the word protocol in Google Trends happened. And I guess because a lot of people were talking about internet protocols for the first time back then it kind of slowly declined. And recently in the last few years, there's been an uptick again, and that's mostly due to blockchains and crypto. So yeah, I think that conversation is finally actually becoming salient. So protocol nerds, as you say, have been around forever, but I think this is kind of the historical moment for this topic to take center stage. So yeah, Dangerous Protocols is one, and I think several other researchers also looked at the book and explored aspects of its themes.
Thanks.
I did want to, I forgot to mention earlier in my opening spiel, in the partnership things we're doing, one of the things we might be looking at later in the year is the Swiss e-identity project. So we are working with an institution there. So that's kind of interesting because I think the Swiss government is the first, that project is the first one to seriously consider some sort of national identity scheme along with the concept of self-sovereign identity and like, you know, blockchain-y things like wallets as the identifying artifact. So we'll be working on that hopefully in fall. So that should be kind of like a direct link to this group's interests. And another thing we're doing in the summer is with some folks from the Singapore government on basically protocols in Southeast Asia. Like it's a region that's an archipelago of islands where there's been like a larger diffuse regional identity, but lots of small countries, similar to the Hanseatic League in Europe. And it's kind of interesting how identities emerge in natural, historic, sort of like decentralized milieus like that. So we're going to be studying the history and culture of that region with identity as one of the threads there as well. So yeah, this is going to be a more, this theme is going to like keep popping up more and more for us, I think.
Cool. Anyone else got any questions? Oh, clear. There you go.
Sure. Thanks. Have you considered studying protocol innovation communities like ours? And when I say ours, I both mean like CCG where you're speaking, but also a place like the Internet Identity Workshop where we've sort of been a nesting ground and seeding ground, depending on your metaphor of like protocol innovation.
So we haven't had any, so since this is a grants program, it's a function of like which projects end up getting proposed and funded. So we haven't looked at living communities as such directly. We did have one really interesting project, which I already mentioned. So David Lang studied the history of standards communities. So that's, of course, more historical. So I just posted that link. We did also have one project, which we haven't yet published yet, by Toby Shorin and Kara Kittel on basically credentials in science. So communities that kind of like steward formal notions of science, so like publishing in journals and stuff, and how outsiders ranging from like crackpots to amateur scientists try to network and like join that community. So that's, I think, an indirect, it's not studying a standards or protocols group like this, but it's almost close, like peer-reviewed academic disciplines function in very similar ways. So that project looked at sort of their practices and how they do gatekeeping and what gets designated as like, you know, legitimate knowledge versus not. And are those practices sound? So that was a project. In terms of like actively studying groups like this, I think that would be enormously interesting. And definitely if projects like that get proposed, I haven't looked through all the proposals for this year yet, but if any like that are in there, definitely they'll get flagged for a deeper look. So yeah, it's a topic of definite interest. And one of the reasons we're running the program the way we are this year in terms of protocol improvement grants is specifically to fund projects that will kind of like do this, how do I put it, in the course of the research. So maybe they want to improve some protocol on like traffic management or whatever. And one of our expectations is in the course of the project, they'll actually connect to the relevant communities. And maybe the form their output will take will be to actually try and get a standard or spec through that particular body or committee. And we think we learn a lot of meta lessons about how these processes work across groups and disciplines by doing that. So not explicitly studying the communities the way an anthropologist might, but sort of like studying them through the process of actually trying to like work through them to get something done. So that's what we're calling protocol entrepreneurship. So we hope our handful of protocol entrepreneurship will give us some sample data points on how these things work in different communities. Does it answer your question?
It does. And I would say that I think we have a gold mine of data with, I think we started keeping documentation of our IIW. Actually, there's some documentation from before, but for sure, like every IIW since IIW 7 has had a book of proceedings, which is sort of notes of all the sessions. And we're at number 38 now. So that's, you know,
that's a significant
body of data to kind of mine and sort of understand the life of sort of how does something start out as an idea on our agenda wall? For example, cloud LDAP was something a gentleman named R.L. Bob, who's passed away, sadly put up on our wall. And that became a protocol that's standardized at the ITF called SCIM, right? And that's happened to several other protocols. But how did that happen? You know, and like what can we learn about what's happened within this sort of protocol nest to inform it? And anyway, so it's, I'm just sharing, like, if you have a grad students or researchers in your, interesting place to like explore with us as a community. And I hope it happens sometime, as I'm happy to have met you guys and excited to dive into the work you've been doing.
And let me actually turn that around and say, since we do have the program open and the deadline is in a few days, if anyone from this community is interested in putting in for I think this would be actually very suitable for one of our micro grants. I think it would. So last year we tried to do something like this. Like one of the projects attempted to do oral histories of people who've been through such standards processes. That project didn't work out, unfortunately. But I think one thing that would be very interesting is if somebody from this community put in a proposal for a micro grant to just write like an informal history of these 38 things that you mentioned. Like that's a lot for random outside layperson to dive into, both in terms of quantity, but also in terms of like literacy and competence in interpreting what they're reading. So I think one really valuable kind of work we could fund, and we'd love to see applications for that, is, you know, just a short essay providing the history of, all right, there's this community and this is what it's achieved over its lifetime. And here's a couple of like anecdotal examples of how this process works and lessons you can take away from it. So I think that would actually be a perfect little project to do as part of the summer protocols. And more generally, I would love it if you guys sort of like hung out a little bit on our forum, so forum.summerofprotocols.com, and sort of like shared the benefit of your accumulated wisdom with our community. So we have lots of general topics. We have lots of specific research threads going on. So yeah, any comments you can share, sort of like referencing your own experiences, that would be very interesting. Yes. Yeah. And in a way, we don't want to reinforce what Josh said about subtraction. The way we are approaching the idea of like a protocol science or protocol studies is not that this particular small group that happened to start it last year and however long this program lasts, maybe a few years, it'll do a certain amount of work. But we kind of want to, what we want to do is have a catalytic effect and basically plant the seeds of the idea of protocols as a general thing worthy of study in lots of other spaces, including your group. So what we'd love to see happen is beyond your specific work on credentials and technical standards around those, if you kind of like started a thread of thinking and discourse in your own community about these broader things and sort of like connected with other groups doing that, including us, and we start seeing a little bit of like cross-pollination and like cross discourse of like, hey, you guys had just had a very tough time getting a particular standard through due to very tricky issues. Maybe there's a lesson there that you can quickly abstract and post in other forums that might be of interest. So we kind of want to create a decentralized network of protocol studies people or protocol nerds. Yeah, dreamed about doing a PhD in protocols. I think that's increasingly going to be a thing. We are hoping there'll be a whole field of people doing PhDs on protocols.
Cool. Any other comments, by the way? Thoughts? I did have a quick question for Spencer, maybe, which is, like I read your paper, I thought it was really interesting. I wonder, like, how have you found the experience of having a memory pouch?
You said making or?
Of using, right? Like of
using,
yeah.
I mean, so both like the physical ones and the digital ones, it's become like a really core part of, I don't know, my everyday life, I would say. Like I think it's, I use the digital ones much more just because they're so prevalent, like for, you know, collecting, inspiration about projects all the way to, I have like this log of, called I Love Living. And it's basically like every time I have this like shortcut that runs on my phone. And every time I sort of have this gratitude for life, I like run the shortcut and it takes a picture and logs the date and time. So that's like the range of how, different it can be. And then, yeah, the physical one has enabled me to, I sort of just think about like that specific, category of archival whenever I take the bag. And so I have one that's sort of like aimed at like flowers. And so whenever I go out, I'm sort of like more, primed to pay attention to flowers. Yeah. So I think it's really changed the way, I don't know, I look at the world, or I sort of have these different textures or lenses for viewing the world through.
Nice. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else so we can close? I mean, it's 5-2. No? Okay, well, thank you, Venkatesh. Josh, Spencer, Chanel, Shane couldn't join. This has been really interesting. I'm really glad you guys joined. I look forward to what the future might hold. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, everybody, for having us.
See ya.
Thank you.